Various things lately have seemed to me to be incredibly coincidental, and I use coincidental in quotes as such. I realize that there are some things that just happen. It's not like everything that happens is somehow connected in some way, but at the same time, I think there are many, many things, and maybe more than we assume, that are specifically caused to happen. And by caused, I don't mean just cause and effect. I mean where God himself is involved, or, in that sense, where Satan himself is involved. One of the very clear incidents of that in my mind is when I was leaving Nigeria on the trip back in November. I've mentioned it before, but it seemed more than coincidental to me that when we arrived in Owerri, there were certain problems that existed in the church there, and after they were expressed to us, then we began to make some decisions on how they should be addressed, and we went on to Benin City. As we arrived in Benin City, there were some problems there as well, and again, we weren't in a position to address them, but we began to put some instruction in place on where those problems could be addressed, and we went on to Lagos, and as we were leaving Lagos, an individual in the congregation there bolted and taking with him assets and the corporate account as such and left our fellowship in that respect. But as I was flying out of Nigeria, in my mind I'm looking back, picturing flames across the country where the church areas were. There were some troubles in each of those places. And I just thought, you know, I just don't believe that's a coincidence. When something happens and it kind of erupts all at once, then something else was going on besides it just happened to be together at the same time. I felt like there had been really a literal assault. In the book of Daniel, there is an account that I think is probably, in some respects, unique in the Bible, and it's because it expresses things that take place that we can't normally see. We might see some of the physical fallout of it, and we might just look at it in a physical perspective, but we don't have the ability to see what's behind the events. We need to know that indeed these things are there, that life works out in these ways. Daniel 10, verse number 1. It says, in the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a message was revealed to Daniel, whose name was called Belshazzar. The message was true, but the appointed time was long. It was prophetic. It was long down in time before it would be fulfilled. And he understood the message, and he had understanding of the vision. He says, in those days, I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 full weeks. Now, mourning here isn't the same as fasting. He says he ate no pleasant food, no meat or wine came to his mouth, nor did he anoint himself at all till the 3 weeks were fulfilled. But he went on some kind of a very simple, basic diet, and he turned his time and attention, apparently, in seeking out and beseeching God and crying out to him, and so that was his total entire focus, it appears. It says, on the 24th day of the first month, I was by the side of the great river, that is the Tigris, and I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen. And what follows here is a description of an angel. Now, the angels that are described in Ezekiel are shown as the cherubim, and they're described at the throne of God. Here is a description of an angel as it appeared here to Daniel as he saw the angel. And it just says that his waist was girded with gold of Uphaz, his body was like beryl, his face like the appearance of lightning, eyes like torches of fire, arms and feet like burnished bronze in color, the sound of his words like the voice of a multitude. It's a description that we really don't have in many other places like this in the Bible. But the point being that God had sent an angel to Daniel with a message in response to Daniel's beseeching God and humbling himself before God in that specific way. Now in verse number 18, if you go to through the passage, not so much the message, but notice what the angel then says after the, at least in this part, the message was delivered. It says, then again, verse 18, the one having the likeness of a man touched me and strengthened me. And he says, O man greatly beloved, fear not. Peace be to you, be strong. Yes, be strong. So when he spoke to me, I was strengthened and said, let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. And he said, do you know why I have come to you? I says, I now must return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I have gone forth, indeed the prince of Greece will come. So the angel is describing the circumstance that God sent him out in response to Daniel seeking God and his word. And the angel went forth, but he was opposed and delayed by a demon along the way. Verse 21, but I tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince. Michael is the one who came to assist. And so it's interesting here that he says, I have to go back and I have to contend with the prince of Persia. And then the prince of Greece will come. And so there were battles that were being waged, contests between the angels, the demons against the holy angels of God. It's interesting if you think of the kingdom of Persia. What country today is the center, the core of where the kingdom of Persia has been historically? And when you see it and you recognize that the prince of Persia is a very powerful demon who has been involved in world affairs, recorded all the way back in here to Daniel, but that much of the history of the Western world as well, the history of Persia in relationship to that, it's Iran. Iran is the seat of the traditional Persian Empire. Now, it is not interesting that today there would be a leader in Iran who would be castigating and criticizing Israel and the Jews and the United States, and who is indeed a traditional enemy of us in one way or another, who has proclaimed that the Holocaust never happened. And if it did happen, then let the Europeans take care of it and ship the Jews back to Europe. But that Israel needs to be essentially driven into the sea, and they have no right to exist. In fact, one day they will not. The leader of a world nation that is led by a demon power that is very, very powerful historically and always has been in place, having an impact in that way. I think it's an important context because what it shows us is that God is doing his work, but Satan is doing his. And some things that would seem to be at times maybe coincidental, spiritually, indeed are not. I grew up in Butte and Anaconda, Montana, in grade school. And I remember Butte, Montana was Berkeley Pit. If you've ever traveled through Butte, Berkeley Pit is a huge open pit copper mine that basically swallowed the upper part of the city. I remember as a kid there was Meaderville. Columbia Gardens was a beautiful park with swings and a roller coaster and rides. As Berkeley Pit continued to expand, it would just gobble up more and more of the town until Columbia Gardens was just, they scraped it off. They picked up actual native copper off the ground on the surface. And then they began to tunnel down and open the pit up again to take out the ore underneath. It is an incredible circumstance. They used to call it the richest hill on earth. They pulled out copper and gold, mostly copper, but some of the other metals that were mixed with it, in phenomenal amounts. They took the ore and they concentrated the ore and they sent it to the smelter that was in Anaconda. And when we left Butte, we moved to Anaconda. And I remember driving into Anaconda, and there would be a sign, the tallest smokestack on earth. Now, if I remember, the last time I was there, they still have the stack. They've torn down the smelter, and now they're going to make it into a golf course or something. Everything gets made into a golf course. But they tore that down, but it was, again, this phenomenal smelter in Anaconda, this huge, huge open-pit mine in Butte, and an enormous amount of wealth. We used to count the train cars as children. And it would be, you know, if the train had over 100 cars, then that was a real train. And we would count them up and we would watch that process. But I want to read you something from a book on Anaconda. I saw it in a bookstore some years ago and picked it up, just used book. I don't even have with me in this case. I just copied a few pages off. The copyright goes back a ways. But Marcus Daly was the general manager of the Anaconda Company as it was forming and before the open pit was fully before it was even developed. But it is interesting, again, you could say a remarkable coincidence and what took place in this country in the United States at that time. Says, this is 1882. He was the general manager and had put together the funding to go in and try to develop that particular mine. Says, the Anaconda developed into fabulous property. It was the richest deposit of copper sulfide that had ever been found. And with it, the large-scale copper mining industry in this country was born. Nothing like its output had ever been found before. This was something at that point in time that was incredibly unique. There was little reason then to hope that copper, as would be then produced out of the Anaconda ore, could successfully compete with native copper ores in the Lake Superior District. There was nowhere to smelt it. There was nowhere to concentrate or refine it. The first ore they took out literally was carried out by mule and then shipped overland all the way back to the east to be refined. The ore that was first taken out of there was 55% copper, pure copper. It was richer than anything that had ever been found in copper ore in any amount on the earth at that time. It says there was also a very limited copper market at that time, and there was nothing that actually warranted a large production of the copper as metal. In 1882, the annual consumption of copper for the entire world represented only about a 2-week supply at the present time, when this book was written. And the book was probably written back in the 50s or 60s. But just saying, the entire world supply back then would supply, you know, no more than 2 weeks back then. But it again, Marcus Daly went in, built the company, began to mine the ore, began to build the business, and began to ship it out of there. When they went to actually have the ore assayed, and again, they mailed it, shipped it back east, the assayers came back and asked by what process they had been concentrating the ore, because it was more concentrated than anything else they had ever seen. And it wasn't concentrate. It was just the ore they were pulling straight out of the mine. Now, what's interesting, at the same time, that was 1882, the Centennial Exposition at Philadelphia in 1876 had revealed the application of electricity for varied usage. At this exposition, Alexander Graham Bell had first transmitted speech through a copper wire in 1876. Heralding the advent of the telephone, which was to use, as the years passed, obviously millions and millions of miles of copper wiring. Equally important was the operation in 1882, the very same year Marcus Daly began to open that mine, of the first electric generating plant to light the streets of New York. Coincidence had been the invention of hard-drawn copper wire and the start of cable development. Now, copper cables were able to now be produced. Arc lighting was demonstrated on a street corner in Newark, and interior electric lights were installed in Wanamaker's store in Philadelphia. In 1880, Edison had received a patent for the incandescent lamp and began to experiment with a trolley car. Now, isn't it incredible? What a coincidence. In the United States, the people who in part were to receive the blessings that came down from the time of Abraham of increase and prosperity, at the time that electricity is basically being learned or figured out in terms of how to utilize it, the electric lighting, streetcars, to where phones can now be made and built, all of which is based on the copper wiring, that there just happened to be a pile of this stuff right over there in Butte that was the richest deposit that had ever been found on the earth. A big one. They were mining that all the way through World War II and depended on it heavily in terms of the development of the armaments in this country at that time. It says there was an additional factor. Copper production in Great Britain, this is now back to 1882, copper production in Great Britain had dropped from 16,000 tons in 1860 to 3,800 tons in 1881. Chile's output was reduced from 50,000 tons to 38,000 tons the same year, while in the United States, production had increased to only 44,000 tons in the year when the Anaconda mine was opened. We were importing copper for our own consumer demand. World production of copper is dropping. The invention of the telephone and the ability of the electric light and all of the things that would follow through with that had just been established in the United States, and here is, coincidentally, the richest pile of copper that was ever found on the face of the earth. Now, you could say, well, yeah, that could indeed be coincidence. That could be coincidence like the fact that the gold was in California instead of Virginia. How many people would have flooded across the United States if somebody said, you know, we just discovered coal in California? I don't think so. But all they had to do was basically when the time was right and God wanted this land to be settled, he simply said, well, there's the gold, boys, go get it. And I'm telling you, the people immediately simply moved across by the tens of thousands, by the multiple tens of thousands to the West Coast. Now, if you live on the West and the East Coast, what's going to happen to the land in between? It's going to be settled. They drove through, they passed through, they hauled their way through those lands, and then some people returned. Isn't it interesting if in prophecy you have a king of the South, a king of the South in the sense of relationship to the Middle East? And if you just go look at the Middle East and then you look at a map and say, well, take a big swapping crease of what the south of that would be, and if you're going to have a king of the south in the end time who is powerful enough to rise up and contend with the king of the north, then there has to be some means for that coalition to come together, some basis for their economy. Isn't it a coincidence that that's where the oil in the world is, and that it wasn't discovered until the end time? And that there are just pools of it, billions of barrels of oil. That's just an amazing coincidence. The fact is, I don't believe those are coincidences. I don't believe it was a coincidence that when Cortez landed on the coast of what is Mexico today, that the Inca, or the Aztec, actually, population, had a tradition that there would be a white god that would visit them coming from the east. Because it was only a few hundred of his men against tens of thousands of Aztec soldiers, and they conquered the empire. Now, that took a lot of setup before they ever arrived. I don't think it was a coincidence that the gold in Mexico and South America went to what nation? Went to Spain. Now, if you're looking again at the descendants of Abraham and God fulfilling his promises, that the fact is, in his intent and plan, one day England is going to rise up as a maritime power and is going to rule the waves and is going to have dominion on the sea gates of the world in a phenomenal way. So where did the gold go? The gold went to Spain first. What did they do with the gold? Well, one thing they did was they built an armada. They built a large fleet of ships with which to transport the gold and to protect it and to have commerce around the world. I think it's an incredible coincidence that just before Britain was in a position to rise to ascendancy, that there was a power in the world that rose first who became the enemy nation that would try to destroy Britain's power in that way. What a coincidence. Isn't it a coincidence that when the first settlers on the eastern coast of the United States established themselves, that there was an Indian, Squanto, there who showed them how to raise crops and how to survive on the land and befriended them and allowed them in various ways to get a foothold and establish themselves and to survive. If you knew history, if I knew history, if you could connect the dots, I think what we would very clearly see, God is doing his work and Satan is doing his. When Christ is going to come on the earth and Satan is there to either offer a counterfeit in advance or try to destroy him when he arrives. It is a constant effort and parallel between what God is doing and what Satan opposes. So then when I go back and again I look at Daniel, and the angel comes to Daniel and says, I'm sorry, but I have to go back. I've got to go contend with the prince of Persia. You ever wonder how angels fight? You know, one gives a big cross, you know, punch, and it goes right through the other one. And the other one does an uppercut, and it goes right through the top, you know. I don't think so. If I really wanted to hurt someone, you could say, well, I could punch them, but they might beat me up. If you wanted to hurt someone, one of the ways to do something is to destroy something they value, destroy something that is important to them, take it and ruin it. God's creation and his people are valuable to him. And Satan comes in oftentimes and creates and produces war and destroys things. And imagine if there was a limit. God says there are limits to where the bounds of the peoples are on this earth, but if there's a limit to the bounds of a particular empire and Satan decides that he wants more power and authority than that and he begins to exceed the empire that God has allotted him for that time, would not other angels have to go in with other forces and cause events to take place that would cause those other forces to pull back to keep their dominion according to their place? I don't know. I can't speak for the angels as such. But Satan's the prince of the power of the air. He affects the world and us in moods and attitudes, and he impacts events in various ways. And so at least we have, by Daniel's account, that the holy angels go out and they contend with that to make sure that God's plan is properly fulfilled. History is the record of God in relationship to his people on this earth. And that's why the Bible talks about Babylon and Egypt and places, because that's where God's people were. And so the history that's shown biblically is a record of that part of this world where God has had his emphasis because of where his investment has been. Rod was mentioning the covenants of the Bible. One of the core elements of the covenant, new and old, is I will be their God and they shall be my people. A personal relationship with God. In the church, we're sons and daughters, part of God's family, holy to God. How closely do we work with our children when we have sons and daughters ourselves? How closely do we care for them, teach them, help them walk, show them how to go forward in this life? It is all we do as they grow up. And everybody says, it's too soon, they're out the door, and they're gone, and it's too late. So you have to work with them while you have them. We work with them intensely closely. How closely do you think God works with his children? It's not like God sets everything in motion. No, he gets set it in motion, but he maintains it. And so he walks with us the same way. When your child is out in the yard playing next to the road and he's in the yard and he's safe, but aren't you watching to make sure, because you've instructed him not to play in the street, but now you're watching to make sure that he doesn't make a mistake until you can know for sure that he knows his boundaries. You think God doesn't do that with us in various ways? You don't think that maybe God, even more than we would work with our children, works with us? Intimately involved. Directing, affecting our lives in an incredible way. John chapter 5 and verse number 16 gives reference to this, at least in a broad way. But John chapter 5, verse number 16. Jesus Christ here had healed a man on the Sabbath. It says the Jews, for this reason, the Jews persecuted him, sought to kill him, because he'd done these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, my Father has been working until now, and I have been working. Now, we know that Jesus Christ was healing individuals and teaching the apostles and going around and preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God. But it says his Father was working too, right up until then. God the Father is not sitting back waiting for the great white throne judgment to end so that he can finally come to the earth and get to work. He's working right now. Working with our lives, watching over decisions that we make, guiding and directing his family. Jesus said, my Father has been working until now, and I've been working. We're busy. We're busy, involved in many, many things. It says, therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, at least as they believed, but he also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. So God has his hand in many, many things. We've said in the past that God's not involved in the politics of this world. Well, in some respects, he indeed is not. It is Satan's system. But in other respects, the Bible clearly shows that God has a hand in what takes place, at least especially in respect to where his people are related, where his people have been. Go back to the book of Daniel, chapter 4, in verse number 17. Here in the midst of one of the descriptions of a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. But notice verse 17, Daniel 4. This decision is by the decree of the watchers, and the sentence by the word of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High, rules in the kingdom of men, gives it to whomever he will, and sets over it the lowest of men. It doesn't sound like he's not involved to me. The Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he will. It doesn't say that God makes every single choice. It does say that he makes those choices that he chooses, but that he is involved. He's working. It's not coincidental that we have a leader in Iran who is absolutely over the edge in terms of any rational or sane response that we can understand at this time in history of the world. It's not a coincidence. It's not a coincidence that they're trying to develop nuclear power, to develop nuclear armaments, no matter what they say. And it's no coincidence that they have a pool of oil sitting down below them, which allows them to get away with it. Romans 13, verse number 1. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. For there's no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Now again, I think in the past we might have had a tendency to kind of edit this a little bit. We would say, well, the authorities that exist are kind of given the authority to be authorities by God. He's given man permission to rule himself, but it doesn't exactly say that. It says the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Now, appointed can mean delegated in terms of authority, but if you put that together with Daniel, God says, I'll raise up over them the basest of men. I will set in place whom I wish. So, at some level, God is involved in the choosing of certain of the political leaders who exercise dominion on this earth. Acts 17, verse 24. Christ said he and his father were busy. They're involved. All these things that happen aren't coincidences because they're involved in our lives. They're involved in what we do today, and when we go on a trip, we ask God to protect us on our journey. Well, if we're asking him to protect us, doesn't he then stop and answer that promise, or not that promise, that prayer? Doesn't he promise by relationship to the new covenant to be involved with us, and our children are holy as well, and he's involved with our children? Now, does that mean nothing ever happens to us? That's not the point. Hebrews 11 shows that some things very bad happened to some of God's people, but it doesn't mean God wasn't with them. It means it was within what he was willing to allow, but he was interested in their character and their commitment and their perseverance. But he was involved. He wasn't signed off. Acts chapter 17, verse 24. Paul here speaking in the midst of Athens. He said, God, who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands, nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life, breath, and all things, and has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation. So the Persian Empire had limits in God's mind in terms of where he would allow it to expand and to exist. And maybe when the demons would go out and say, well, we'd like to push out the barriers a little bit further, God had to send an angel and confront them and stop them and bring about events that would stop them in their tracks, or maybe cause a storm to come down and rain over the field where Napoleon was trying to win his battle at Waterloo, so that when the cannonballs hit, they just sunk in the mud instead of blowing up in the open and taking out the opposing soldiers. There's no way to exactly go back and say what happened in each case. But God has power over those things, and his angels serve him in that way. Are they not servants for those who are called to be heirs of salvation? Are they not involved in our lives dramatically? I mean, I wish I knew how many angels were here in this proximity. It would be interesting. Obviously, God doesn't care that we know such things, because we would probably be distracted. But I don't have any doubt that they're here, that they have, in various ways, focused on you and I and what we do and in our lives. And I am grateful for God's kindness in that specific way. I mentioned to the congregations in Owerri, as I wrote a letter that would be read on their first combined meeting, because there were five small congregations that were going to combine centrally into a single congregation. And I mentioned in a sermon that that was going to be tough for some of them, because they live in the villages and they don't all have cash. They have food, but they don't all have cash. And to get on a motorcycle or to get into a little bus for transportation takes cash. And so you have to sell some of your food, or you have to do some exchange or barter, or you have to have some products of some kind in which you achieve some increase. And I encourage them to put God first. Trust him, obey him, do what he says. True religion, as Rod was addressing. And then to also trust God to bless them. See, it's not going to be a coincidence that this is a good year. It's going to be a direct intervention by God in response to a servant who is faithful and loyal and trying to put him first. So I said, trust God to bless you, but do what he says. Put him first. If we look at Deuteronomy 28, we see one of the chapters that we have referred to as the blessings and the curses. And we can say, well, okay, Deuteronomy 28, those were blessings to a nation, where the weather patterns, where the banking system as such, where all of this was in place together. And you know what? That's true. It was. But Romans 8:28 says, all things work together for good to those who love God in the New Covenant, in the New Testament. James 5 and verse 16 says, the effective fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Now, that was in the context of healing. But the point is that when you serve God and put him first, and you are righteous by having his righteousness imputed to you in forgiveness, and because you are a servant of God who is faithful, it says if you pray fervently, it's very effective. There's a response to it. There's a response to that. So Deuteronomy 28 is given to Israel, but the principles obviously apply in various ways to us today. But look at this. Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations on the earth. You know what? I'll show you, I'll make you have some inventions, and then I'll put a pile of copper right next door. You can dig out of the ground and make those inventions work. And you'll have more of it than anybody on the face of the earth. All these blessings will come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. In the case of the United States, it was Abraham who obeyed. In the case of you and me, it must be us. Blessed shall you be in the city, blessed shall you be in the country. Blessed shall be the fruit of your body. Don't we want a blessing on the fruit of our body? The produce of your ground, the increase of your herds, the increase of your cattle, the offspring of your flocks. Blessed shall be your basket, your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in, blessed shall you be when you go out. Now, God doesn't give us just prosperity as such. We don't preach prosperity gospel. But do we go to God and cry out to him in prayer and ask him to intervene in various ways? We certainly do. And we need to. And God responds. The Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven. The Lord will command a blessing on you and your storehouses and all to which you set your hand. He will bless you in the land which the Lord your God has given you. probably the most striking example I've already used in the past, but just to, as a refresher on what this point is addressing in part, there was a family in Boise, Idaho, who had a garden outside their trailer that they grew vegetables in to sell at the co-op to go to the feast. And there was a drought that year, and the grasshoppers were just chocked full in the fields. And I went out to their house, and I walked out with them into the garden, and the grasshoppers weren't coming past the barbed wire fence. Barbed wire fence. I walked through the garden. They had corn. They had vegetables. They had spinach. They made a lot of spinach. Grasshoppers love spinach. You know, it's just, that's what makes them so strong. And literally, I could look on one side of the barbed wire fence, and it was grasshoppers hopping through the dry and open field. And on the other side of the barbed wire fence was their garden they depended on to go to the feast. And there wasn't hardly, there may have been a grasshopper in there, but there was hardly a grasshopper in sight. And it was just across the line. And I'm just saying, you know, if we can't trust God, who can we trust? But we have to submit ourselves to Him. He says, obey diligently, carefully observe His commandments, put God first. So that's what I was trying to encourage the brethren there. I says, look, I realize you don't have the means to always travel to come together. But you can put God first, and He can bless the hand you have. He can bless the sales of your business. He can give you increase. It's He who called us to assemble. And the assembly was for the strength of the congregation, so that those who taught would be faithful, and so that those who are being taught would hear those who are faithful, and not someone who's simply raising up a group of people in his village for his own purposes. And it was important that that be done. Genesis 39, in a more of a specific case here. Genesis 39 and verse number 20. Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. The keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there was his doing. The keeper of the prison didn't look at anything that was under Joseph's hand, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. Acts chapter 7, on the other end of the Bible here in regard to this same thing in a different part of the story, though. Acts chapter 7 and verse number 9. And the patriarchs, becoming envious, sold Joseph into Egypt, but God was with him and delivered him out of all his troubles. Now, it didn't say he didn't have troubles. It just said God delivered him out of the troubles and gave him favor and wisdom in the presence of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Gave him wisdom. Now, you have the Word of God, you have the Proverbs, you can gain wisdom, but it's also a gift of God where He works with our minds and gives us good judgment. Made him governor over Egypt and over all of his house. When Daniel was taken in to be taught by the chief of the eunuchs, the book of Daniel says that God brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs, that he gave him favor and goodwill. Who did Christ have the most compassion for, at least in the Bible record? On what group of people did he show the most compassion and concern for? Sinners, right? Sinners. What group did Christ rebuke? Which ones did he castigate openly and directly and forcefully? The Pharisees. Now, some of the Pharisees were indeed sincere. Paul was a Pharisee. He was sincere. Had to change his direction. But there were Pharisees who were later converted and became a part of the body of Christ. But many of the Pharisees were hypocrites. They were very religious. And they made a show of religion, but they did not genuinely turn their heart to God and obey Him. It was like they played some kind of a game. Go to Psalm 34 in terms of who God looks to and works with and has mercy on. who he's involved in their lives in a very direct way, or whose lives is he involved with. Psalm 34, verse number 15. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. Who are the eyes of the Lord? Well, at least in part, they're angels. The eyes of the Lord are on the righteous. And his ears are open to their cry. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil, cut off remembrance of them from the earth. The righteous cry out, and the Lord hears, and delivers them out of all their troubles. Doesn't say, prevents them from having troubles. The Lord is near to those who have a broken heart, who say and save such as have a contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He guards all his bones, not one of them is broken. Evil shall slay the wicked. Those who hate the righteous shall be condemned. The Lord redeems the soul of his servants, and none of those who trust in him shall be condemned. What God hates is hypocrisy. Those who profess religion, but do not live accordingly. One of the books that I just finished reading, because it was very thin and had big print, was Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave. I mentioned it again. I just hadn't had a chance to really use it very much. It was my $3 book from Barnes & Noble's. There was one place in the book, there's only one thing in the book that I actually stopped and underlined and made a little star and said, I must save that. There's many things in here that I thought were of great interest. He talked about freedom and how education is freedom. He talked about the holidays, the winter holidays, the Christmas holidays, and how they were used to further keep the blacks in bondage in their slavery. And I'd never heard that before. But the slave owners would encourage the blacks to be drunk and during that time to celebrate so excessively that it was actually a relief when it was over. And to try to give them any taste of freedom they had, even how small it was, and to give it a negative association. And he describes how they used the holidays, the Christmas and end of the year holiday time, to encourage that negative association with freedom in a slave's eyes. It was incredible. To cause them, to encourage them, to almost cajole them into going to excess so that they would be glad it was over and they could go back to their slavery. It's unbelievable, some of the statements that he made in here. But he says, on the 1st of January, 1834, I left Mr. Covey and went to live with a Mr. William Freeland, who lived about 3 miles from St. Michael's. He's just showing the area. It was kind of in the Maryland area, where he was a slave. I soon found Mr. Freeland a very different man from Mr. Covey. Though not rich, he was what would be called an educated Southern gentleman. Mr. Covey, as I have shown, was a well-trained Negro breaker and slave driver. So he was describing what he had gone through and the whippings, and it's a, in some places, very graphic book. He said, another advantage, I'll pass over part of it, but he said, another advantage I gained in my new master was he made no pretensions to or profession of religion. And this was, in my opinion, a truly great advantage. I assert most unhesitatingly that religion, the religion of the South, is a mere covering for the most horrid crimes, a justifier of the most appalling barbarity, a sanctifier of the most hateful frauds, and a dark shelter under which the darkest, foulest, grossest, and the most infernal deeds of slaveholders find the strongest protection. Were I to again be reduced to the chains of slavery, he escaped and eventually became a freed man. His friends purchased his freedom. Were I to again be reduced to the chains of slavery, next to that enslavement, I should regard being a slave of a religious master the greatest calamity that could befall me. Can you imagine a slave looking at religion in that way? Sounds like Babylon, does it not? The Babylon mystery religion. I mean, it's a religion that is a facade. It's hypocrisy. It's pretending to be righteous, but indeed not putting God first. Since, for of all the slaveholders with whom I have ever met, religious slaveholders are the worst. I have ever found them the meanest and the basest, the most cruel and cowardly of all others. It was my unhappy lot not only to belong to a religious slaveholder, but to live in a community of such religionists. He goes through then and picks out particular individuals by name and describes the condition of their slaves and the circumstances of where they had lived and how they treated them. At the end, he says, there was not a man in the whole county with whom the slaves who had to get in their own home would not prefer to live rather than with the Reverend Mr. Hopkins. And yet there was not a man anywhere around who made higher profession of religion, was more active in revivals, more attentive to the class, love feast, prayer, and preaching meetings, more devotional in his family that prayed earlier, later, louder, and longer than the same Reverend slave driver Rigby Hopkins. You know, when I read that, it was just sad. The hypocrisy of those who, like the Pharisees, pretend to put God first but do not live it. They don't live it in their relationships. They don't live it in the congregation. They don't live it on the job. They don't live it in the community. It's a game to be religious, to appear righteous. I go back to some of the stories in Nigeria of people coming into what was then the early church as we know it, who then carried with it this presence of being religious and who would then beat and just abuse their children because they were the masters. It's incredible. It is a very sad statement. Christ had mercy for the sinners. He rebuked the hypocrites. When we turn around and it says, God, you know, comes to us and he calls us into relationship. And then he says, if you will diligently obey me, if you will do as I ask you, I will invest myself in your life and I will guide and direct you. I will bless you. I'll bless the fruit of your loins. I'll bless your crops. I'll bless the work of your hands, either in the city or the country. You will be mine. You know, it's not a coincidence when God is active in our lives and something goes well. It's not just happenstance. It is indeed a blessing by his hand. In Ephesians 6, in verse number 10, Paul writing, he says, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Stand against the opposition that will surely be there, but by trusting in God, God has all might. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood. This isn't just a physical contest in this flesh, but against principalities, powers, against the rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Is it not a coincidence, so to speak, when God's people are blessed, that they have served God and put him first, and in turn he has blessed their hand and blessed their heart and blessed their mind? It's obviously not a coincidence at all. It's not a coincidence that we are here in this room today. It's not a coincidence that God called us individually. It's not like he just scattered a bunch of seed and he says, I wonder who's going to pick the seed up. It's not like that. God has scattered the seed and then he called us one by one by one. And one of the things that we've learned in Nigeria is when they walk in the door by 50, that you don't know who came in, because you don't know who God worked with individually. They all came together. And later on, sooner or later, then some raise their hand and show by their fruits that indeed they have no intention of putting God first. They just came along for the ride. But when God calls us, it's not a coincidence. It is indeed direct divine intervention in our lives. We can trust on that and we can depend on that. When we have opposition, it's not a coincidence either. I'm not saying there is no time and chance. I'm saying the stakes are real. Satan's opposition is real, and God's protection is even more real. God says, put me first, submit yourself to me fully, and I will guide and direct your life. You are mine. You are the sheep of my pasture.